From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Ollie. I wonder, does Tommy Robinson know where Gabon is? I wonder, has Tommy ever heard of Gabon? Maybe not. Well, welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Show. How you doing? It's the 7th of January, 2019.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Asher, Tommy might surprise you. You know, Tommy just might surprise you. You never know. Are you well? Are you? Are you wet? It's bloody wet
it's
in Manchester.
The Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
I'm going to be speaking to a lady in the second hour of the program. I can't believe we've never met. Her name is Jackie Fletcher, and she's a fairly extraordinary lady, to say the least. Jackie fought for nearly two decades to win compensation for her boy Robert, who suffered brain damage after being given the MMR vaccine. Now, Jackie was featured in Del Bigtree's film Vaxxed with Dr. Andy Wakefield. Why do we want to talk to Jackie today? Well, she's a very interesting woman, but The Guardian newspaper has run a podcast overnight which claims that people who ask questions about vaccines are in fact putting other people's lives at risk. This isn't funny. It's very serious. And I want to talk to that. I talked to Jackie about that, but also something called yellow card, the yellow card system. This is where doctors are supposed to flag up any suspicion that a vaccine has caused harm. Jackie has evidence that doctors in the UK are not doing that. We're going to talk about it in the second hour. Before that, I welcome back a very old friend to the programme. Dr. Alex Scott Samuel is a senior lecturer in public health and policy at the University of Liverpool. He's a lovely guy, very smart man. We're going to talk about this NHS plan for the next few years, this 20 billion quid for early intervention, for better provision of mental health services, and what it really means. Alex Scott Samuel was in Liverpool today, where Theresa May was also present as she gave a speech outlining this particular plan. She was also with the head of NHS England, a guy who might be called Simon Stevens. Think that might be his name. I've not got it in front of me. So it's a packed old show, as usual. If you'd like to tell me anything, you can tell me, you know you can tell me anything, right? Anything. Anything. You can tweet it to me. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Best way to reach me during the programme. And I'm delighted to be back. I'm going to say no more about it because I've said it a few times over the last day or so. Packed old show, yeah. And I've got a good week as well of guests that I'm waiting for rubber stamping approval acceptance. I'm 99% sure of a couple of really cracking guests to come on the show in the week whom we've never heard from before, at least on this programme anyway. Now, the MPs, that's the Members of Parliament, have been discussing today the Sky News petition to establish a commission to oversee leaders' debates. Yeah, they're actually wasting time and money on that old tosh. They're currently debating whether to establish a commission to make leaders' debates a mandatory thing in the future. Ah, well, who cares, eh? Do you want a bit of Brexit? Do you want a bit of Brexit? I'm going to brighten your day. I'm going to brighten your day. I'm going to make you smile. Because you have to smile sometime, don't you? I've got something that's going to make you smile. I'm convinced of it. So a week tomorrow then, that's Tuesday week, tomorrow week, there will be a vote in Parliament on Theresa May's deal. Lovely. Lovely. Theresa May is trying to get some more concessions from the European Union before the vote takes place next week. So according to the BBC then, and I will read from the BBC, May has said she is working on getting further assurances from the European Union to help her win the Commons vote on her Brexit deal. The PM said after delaying the vote last month, controversially, there was some further movement from the EU. That's what she said. She said further measures would be set out ahead of the vote set for the 15th of January tomorrow week. However, contradicting May, which has become a national sport. Well, it's become a European sport anyway. The EU Commission has said there will be no renegotiation. Huh? You hear that? No more negotiation, says the EU. A spokesman said everything on the table has been approved and the priority now is to await events in the UK. Also today, more than 200 MPs signed a letter to Theresa May urging her to rule out a no-deal Brexit, which is one where the UK leaves the EU without any agreed arrangements, right? Which I think would be a good thing. There was a bizarre exercise today involving more than 100 lorries. This was going on in Kent today to test out how to manage traffic queues near the Channel ports in the event of a no-deal Brexit. What does that mean in English, Richie? Well, they're scaring the piss out of people now. They're scaring the piss out of people. That's what they're doing. Scaring the piss out of people. The UK's Big Four news media thingies, BBC, Sky, ITV and Channel 4, have all erected platforms again in Parliament Square. Now, you might remember they did this before Christmas. It's ridiculous. There's no need for it. It is madness. No need for them to be standing there broadcasting with the walls of Westminster in the background. There's no need for it. But I think it's madness with some method. I think there is methodology to the madness. Now, Sky in particular, just to pick on Sky, long ago moved away from reporting the news. Doesn't do that anymore, Sky. It now creates a narrative or a story, or tries to. It invents news. We see that with their plastic campaign in the oceans and their campaign to get leaders' debates and their campaigns on knife crime. Sky's supposed to be reporting on stuff. It's now inventing news. And you see a lot of this on their afternoon matinees with Kay Burley, the gorgeous Kay Burley. Now, one of the reasons Sky is placing its anchors in Westminster in the freezing cold is to throw fuel on the bonfire of Brexit chaos. How does Sky do that? Well, by presenting shows close to protesters who begin screaming and shouting every time the anchor does a link or an interview, it creates utter chaos. And Sky loves it. Loves it. Now, today, they've allowed a rabble of pro-Brexit men to scream and shout down the shows all day long. Have you seen some of this? It's proper funny, this. It's ridiculous. In fact, I've never seen anything as preposterous in all my life, but there's method in the madness. Now, it reached a crescendo this afternoon when Kay interviewed Anna Soubry, former business minister. Anna is now back on the back benches. Now, Anna Soubry is a rabid Remainer. She wants a second referendum, to hell with the result of 2016. Because of that, she's been getting into bed with opposition MPs like Chuka O'Munna. Chuka O'Munna. Not literally in bed now. Imagine Anna Soubry and Chuka O'Munna in bed. Yeah. It's not good. I hope you weren't eating. All right, so I told you once, if I've told you a million times, I'm just a big kid, right? Do you want to hear Soubry and Kay Burley against the baying mob today? Very good, this. Sky comes back from a break a little bit too early for Kay. She's all flustered. It's brilliant, this. Take them out of their comfy studios and they literally, Patsy Cline it, they fall to pieces.
Straight on.
Level.
Hello again, you are watching Sky News. We're using one of these microphones just now. Anna Soubry's just arrived, actually. So what we're going to do is get Anna on the telly now.
Let's get Anna on the telly. Let's get Anna on the telly. And then,
because we want to talk to you about the Brexit debate, we need you to use one of those microphones, Anna, if that's okay. So what we're going to do, we're live at the moment, so let's get that.
I'm so sorry, Kay.
What the hell was that, Kay Burley? What in the name of bejesus was that? What was that? What? What was that? Well, Kay was excited anyway. Now, Anna Soubry has been in touch with the CPS, otherwise known as the Crown Prosecution Service, to see if the protesters are in fact committing crimes. Yeah.
Well, I don't think we get used to it, but we shouldn't do. Apparently it's democracy in action.
Excellent.
And the CPS believe that no offences are being committed.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Brexit debate, should we?
Yeah.
So, it kicks off again on Wednesday.
The protesters are singing football songs and replacing footballers' names with Soubry. And some of the songs are, well, they're pretty raw to the bone. It's quite funny, right? So she's been in touch with the CPS to see if the protesters are committing a crime. So they waffled away about Theresa May and next week's vote. Then Kay asked Soubry about the rabble of rowdy revellers and their chanting. What do you make of that, Anna?
How do you feel about this sort of... I mean, as you said, it's part of the democratic process, or at least that's what the police are saying.
Look, I don't have a problem with people demonstrating and making their views heard. Of course not. I have a real problem with people who call me a traitor or Soubry, you Nazi.
Yeah.
That is a criminal offence. I'm an old criminal barrister. I'm also a lass from Worksop, so I don't get scared by these people.
They don't scare me. I'm a lass from Worksop. They must be tough around Worksop. I have no idea. But Anna Soubry's not scared. But this is still very serious.
No. People are intimidated. And I was a reporter, remember, for Central during the miners' strike.
Yeah. I was a reporter for Central during the miners' strike, meaning I lied for the government during the miners' strike. Hence, I advanced from the media and from the law into politics. It was a perfect fit, Anna Soubry.
Yeah. So that doesn't... I don't feel physically intimidated. If there's anything, my difficulty is I want to respond, and you mustn't, and I know that. No. So I'm really behaving myself, because you might imagine what I'd like to do. But this is seriously worrying. These people are members of, a lot of them, the English Defence League. They support people like the so-called Tommy Robinson man.
They support people like the so-called Tommy Robinson man. The so-called Tommy Robinson man. Soubry probably has no idea who these protesters are, because she hasn't spoken to them. So you can't say who it is they support and what it is they represent. They're morons, these guys. They've been shouting and singing abusive stuff, but it's a free country. At least it's supposed to be a free country. Sky can always go indoors and broadcast indoors from the comfort of their soundproofed studios. They could do that. I mean, it has been farcical today. In many instances, Sky had politicians, and you could not, as a viewer, hear what was being said because of the stuff coming from the lads situated only 15, 20 feet away from the platform. So they could go indoors. I think the guys are morons, personally, but I wouldn't arrest them. I wouldn't stop them. It's a free country. At least it's supposed to be. So why doesn't Sky go indoors? Because Sky is loving this. I've written about this, haven't I? I've written about what has become of rolling news and rolling news channels. They are matinee. They are weekday afternoon soap operas. That's what they have replaced. And Sky News is loving it because Sky is in the process of creating a story. You can hear it in the excitement in Kay Burley's voice. There you are. Loving it. Just loving it is Kay. Soubry says that Brexit is for these people. Brexit is all about football hooligans and fascists.
These are fascists, and overwhelmingly, it seems as well, many of them are racists.
Fascists and racists, eh?
They have no regard for law at all.
No regard for law at all!
And I'm afraid the truth is Brexit has unleashed these people. This is...
There were never any football hooligans, and there was never any chanting, or any of that before Brexit, apparently. Brexit did it. It brought these guys out of the woodwork, according to Anna Soubry.
Britain now. This is not the Britain I know and love. And these people do not represent our country. And they need sorting out.
What do you think can be done?
Kick them in the balls, Kay. Kick them all in the balls. Give them a lollipop and send them home for tea with the Queen. You see what's happening here? the police won't move on the football song chanters, even though some of them are definitely in breach of public order law. They're in breach of the Public Order Act. There's no doubt about it. Now, I have no problem with it. Listen, I have no problem with it. I don't want to see people locked up. I certainly don't want to see people arrested for singing songs that have a sexual undertone to them. I don't want to see people locked up for that. But there are laws covering that. So why are they not being moved on? Because they are being presented as Brexit. Look at that scum. That's what it is, isn't it? This is your racist Brexit. That's why Kay doesn't care. She's loving it. The worse it gets. And some of the stuff that's been said about Kay Burley, and you can hear it. I'm not going to repeat it because it isn't funny. And it's not anything I would ever say about anybody, any woman or any man. But you can hear it. It's perfectly audible through your TV speakers. But they're creating their own news. They're making it up as they go along. And maybe trying to plant a seed maybe in the minds of the viewers that, look, Brexit is all about this rabble, this vile scum. What was interesting today was at one point or another, these guys were screaming, free Melanie Shaw. And I have a lot of interest in Melanie Shaw, of course. I interviewed Melanie 3 or more years ago a couple of times, and I spoke to her a few times off air. And I don't think any of these guys really have any idea who Melanie Shaw is or what happened to her. But I will be talking more about Melanie Shaw in the coming weeks. I just want to give you a heads up on that. It's coming up for 20 minutes past the hour, by the way. This is the Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2, tune in radio, triggerwarning.tv, and of course, richieallen.co.uk. Faisal tweets, I wouldn't be surprised if Sky hired these protesters themselves. Never leave anything to chance. You couldn't rule it out, Faisal, but I would suggest, and I don't know for a fact, you might be right, these guys do exist. And it's just a matter of letting them get close enough to the television channels and all of that. By the way, before we move on, Anna Soubry left Sky News, walked from their platform over to the BBC platform and told the BBC what had happened to her when she was on Sky and when she was walking around the square. You see how this is all a news story generated out of absolutely nothing. This is Soubry having run to the BBC to tell them about all the abuse that she's getting. Here she is.
Then we need to have proper votes as to what could be acceptable to Parliament. We need a positive vote against no deal. And in the event of an impasse, which I think there will be, get this matter back to the British people as soon as possible.
Well, at the moment, the feeling seems to be here that if there's an impasse, if there's a vote against, she will go away, she'll come back and say, let's have another vote because I've got perhaps another concession from the EU. This could go on for a while.
No, and that's why that's the other thing that has now got to happen, is we have to be absolutely... I do object to being called a Nazi, actually.
Right. Well, apologies to you if you're offended by what you're listening to.
I just think this is astonishing. This is what has happened to our country, actually. This is what's happened to our country. But anyway, let's try and move on and be positive about things.
Ah, get over it, you silly old tart. The slings and arrows of public life. Some football fans are calling you a Nazi. I'm sure you'll survive the night, you know. These are mad times. 22 minutes past the hour. Lovely to be with you, by the way. Are you well? This is your Richie Allen Show, the first one proper for 2019. My name is Richie Allen. Welcome to the programme, Monday, January 7th. This is Lenny Kravitz and Fly Away, back with Alex Scott Samuel in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere. Tweet the show, it's at Richie Allen Show. Lenny Kravitz on the Richie Allen Show, 24 minutes past the hour for Monday's programme. At the beginning of a brand new week, like I said, I've got some really interesting men and women lined up over the course of the week. I'll tell you more about it later on. Stay with the programme on Twitter. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. And you'll see updates there. And richieallen.co.uk, updates about forthcoming guests and the like. Alrighty. So let's crack on then with the programme. Talked quite a bit about plans for the NHS yesterday, didn't I? quite a bit on Sunday View because it was in pretty much every one of the Sunday newspapers yesterday that NHS bosses in England say that a new 10-year plan could save up to 500,000 lives by primarily focusing on prevention and early detection. Doctors, mental health and community care will get the biggest funding increases to shift the focus away from hospitals. Theresa May, the Prime Minister, was in Liverpool today unveiling this plan, said that the plan itself is a truly historic moment. But doctors, senior doctors, hospital administrators and unions, well, they're not buying it. They're not buying it at all. Let's get to the bottom of it and welcome back an old friend of mine to the programme. He's a senior lecturer in public health and policy at the University of Liverpool. He's a socialist, he's a gentleman, and he's somebody I think that you really should be paying attention to. Let's welcome back to this programme. It's been a while, Dr. Alex Scott Samuel. Alex, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, Richie. Happy New Year. Good to hear you.
It's great to hear you and Happy New Year to you. Many happy returns, Alex. Thanks for sparing us some time today. Now, you were there today. Did Theresa May get a warm welcome from Liverpudlians?
She did indeed. There were about 100 people and an awful lot of banners and Liverpool Socialist Singers, which I'm a member of, were there. And I'm pleased or sorry to say there were very loud boos as the motorcade arrived at about 11 o'clock and then about 90 minutes later when it left. Obviously, we didn't get to see herself. The car had smoky windows, so we couldn't even see who was inside it. But obviously, we knew it was her. But she got a good scouse welcome, yes.
Good stuff. I often wonder about the Conservative Party having conferences, as they've done in recent times in Manchester and Liverpool, and unveiling strategies in these cities. They're not very welcome in this part of the world, and yet they come up here. I wonder about the logic behind that, or what sort of a statement they're making, but maybe that's a discussion for another day. Talked a bit about this on the Sunday newspaper show yesterday, and there's a lot of talk here about the nanny state, people, you know, worried about intervening very early on when people become pregnant for the first time and all of that. Why are so many, but before we talk about some of that, why are so many senior clinicians and administrators and unions saying that this whole idea is a non-starter, saving 500,000 lives through early intervention is a non-starter? Why is there so much scepticism around it? It sounds like a reasonable plan on the face of it.
Well, there's several answers to that. I think one main reason for scepticism is that, as everybody knows, the NHS, along with the rest of the public sector, has been savagely cut back in recent years. And even though the government are claiming that this new plan is putting additional funds into the NHS, the sums it's putting in over the next 5 years are more or less equivalent to what's been taken out of the NHS since the Conservatives came into government in 2010. So the funds are not really a big deal, and they won't really enable the new developments that the government has claimed they will, not without massive cuts. And of course, that's the other aspect of the plan that the government is keeping quiet about, that the only way they're going to be able to do some of the things that they claim they're going to do is by making cuts in other services. And we already know both that there have been cuts and closures in particular services, and in addition, increasingly for the first time really, NHS services are being rationed by the government. So this plan, for example, refers to 17 particular services which are no longer going to be routinely available on the NHS. And even though they claim that this is supported by their NICE agency, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, in fact, if you look into it, as we have, only two of those 17 services are no longer recommended by NICE. So they're clearly saying one thing and doing another.
So they're robbing Peter to pay Paul on the one hand, and on the other hand, it isn't new money because it's money that's been cut in the last decade or nearly a decade anyway. This is interesting stuff. Let me just remind our listeners, Dr. Alex Scott-Samuel is live on the line to us from Liverpool. I know there will be lots of comment on this. You can follow Alex on Twitter. I'll tweet a link to his Twitter account. If you've got a comment on this, tweet it to me now. It's at Richie Allen Show. So what's going on, Alex? What's really going on here?
Well, the other thing to say just before I answer that question is that there is obviously a crucial relationship between health and social care. And we've not yet had the green paper, so-called, the consultative document on social care, which we've been promised for several years. They claim that's going to come out in the next month, but we've no idea what that will say and how it will affect NHS services, because obviously an awful lot of NHS expenditure relates from the inadequacies of social care due to the unbelievably massive cutbacks in local government, which we all know about. Basically, the Tories have savaged local government, even Tory areas, but particularly non-Tory areas. And depending on what they do to social care, that will increase or more likely reduce the credibility of their health proposals. Sorry, because I said that, Richie, I've forgotten what the question was.
No, I asked you what's really going on, but before we talk about that, a listener got in touch with me today, who was very fond of you, and said, Richie, when you speak with Alex later on, can you ask him about, it's gone, let me just bring it up here now. It was to do with, the question I was asked to put to you was, we've seen in the last week or so, in the lead up to this announcement, we've seen a lot of talk about people making themselves ill through their own selfish behaviour, through eating too much or drinking too much or smoking too much. Also, going along with that, we've had a lot of comments thrown at senior citizens. People are living too long. They're living much longer than they used to and all of that. So all of that is going on. And the listener wanted me to put to you the idea that really, people who are overweight and people who smoke are not putting any more pressure on the NHS now than they used to. What's really putting pressure on the NHS are government policies in other areas. You just talked about social care there, but also around benefits and the benefit system. That these things that are hurting people are driving people to illness more than people eating too much sugar or people smoking too much or drinking too much. I thought it was a brilliant point that my friend made today. Do you go along with that?
In fact, there's a very good editorial in this week's BMJ, which I'm not necessarily expecting people to go and look up. But just to say, the well-known health inequalities professor, Danny Dorling from Oxford University, and a couple of his colleagues have got an editorial in this week's BMJ about the prevention aspects of the long-term plan. And what they're essentially saying is it's completely false to take the line that the government takes, the so-called victim-blaming line, that it's all down to individual responsibility and it's up to you without any help from anyone else to make your health better. Obviously, there are lots of choices we take which do affect our health. I wouldn't for a minute deny that. But we also know that there are many, many ways in which government can help us, for example, by providing smoking cessation services, by seriously engaging with the food industry, which does so much through sugar and fat and salt in their products and so on, to increase high blood pressure and heart disease and so on. And this government is absolutely appalling. Do you remember they had something called the Responsibility Deal, which was basically about them sitting around a table with food and other companies of that sort and asking them to change their policies and practices, which of course they didn't do. It's the same with fixed odds betting terminals, which of course caused not just an awful lot of poverty, but dreadful effects on health. And the government was really slow to acknowledge that and then to do anything about it. And it's the same with everything. Because of this false notion of sort of libertarianism that Tories like and that goes with this idea of the nanny state, they're just not willing to come to grips, to practice what we call healthy public policy. In other words, to push through government policies that helps make people healthier. And I don't call that the nanny state. The term I've coined for that is the mummy state, because a state which passes policies which support us and promote our health is like a mummy. You know, it's warm and comforting and supportive. It's not a nanny, which, of course, all the Tories who invented that term had when they were children and so on.
Is there a danger, Alex? Sorry to interrupt you. Is there a danger? Because I'm not against that in principle. Now, I'm neither right-wing nor left-wing nor centrist at all. I'm apolitical.
I believe, but thousands wouldn't.
No, thousands wouldn't, but no, I'm not. But I know I do have a lot of listeners who probably would say that their politics are on the right. So they might say, okay, it's good what Alex is saying. Yes, governments should do as much as they can to promote, to work with people rather than telling people what they must do, but to work with them to show them there's a healthier way. When does that become scary? And when does that become law? Or when does it become legislated for, to the point where people are then told that they will be denied access to health services further down the road if you don't take the advice you were given?
Yeah. Well, first thing is, there's not a simple answer to the question of when it becomes scary, because everyone has different red lines. There's no single absolute answer. It's a relative thing where each of us draws our red line. I mean, I hate the idea that every single email I send is monitored by GCHQ and the American government. But many people would say that's the sacrifice we make in order to have security against terrorism and so on. So it's about where different people draw their red lines. And ultimately, I think these things have to be the result of democratic decisions. And that's why I'm a political animal, because I believe in democracy. Sorry, what was the other part?
No, but you, let's stay with this, Alex. You never, I don't believe, because you spent over two decades in the NHS. And to be fair to you, as you know, alongside your job at Liverpool University, by the way, it's Dr. Alex Scott Samuels, folks, senior lecturer in public health and policy at Liverpool University. Alongside that, you're a great advocate for access to healthcare and access to decent healthcare for everybody. I can't imagine somebody like you would ever in the future say, well, look, that guy has got himself into that situation himself. He was repeatedly told not to take this, not to eat this. He did. We can't keep admitting him and treating him. I don't believe you'd ever say that.
I would never say never. And the reason I put it that way is because there are medical red lines. I'm not now talking about what you or I or people listening to this might think. I'm talking about medical red lines. In other words, before you or I can have an operation that involves a general anaesthetic, we have to be passed medically by the anaesthetist. And clearly there are medical red lines which could relate to obesity or other health problems that could be said in some way to relate to lifestyle choices, where the anaesthetist will say, I'm sorry, I don't have a moral attitude to your smoking or your diet, but you're not medically fit to have an anaesthetic. There's less chance that you'll survive it because, for example, you're grossly obese or your respiratory function is so bad as a result of your smoking habit over many decades or whatever, that I'm just not prepared to subject you to an anaesthetic. And clearly, those kind of judgments I would go along with.
Of course, as a medical man, of course you would. But the moral judgment. I mean, I'll give you.
No, I agree with you. I totally agree that moral judgments in those circumstances are not acceptable. And if part of the implication of this long-term plan, and I've only literally just downloaded it because it was only published this morning, so I don't know whether it actually says people who refuse to do X, Y, Z about their smoking or their diet will be denied care. I don't know, to be honest, whether it says that or not. But if it does, then I would agree with you that those are moral judgments and that those are unacceptable.
Yeah, it's a dystopian future, that, isn't it, Alex? Alex is going to stay with me till the top of the hour, and then he's got better things to do. There are loads of comments coming in. Rich is not happy about the idea that it's okay for GCHQ to read our emails to keep us safe when GCHQ and the intelligence agencies of this country and others do far more harm overseas than some terrorist groups. That's a good point. I would agree with that. Alex is just making the point. He wasn't saying he endorses GCHQ.
Oh, no.
Looking at our emails or anything like that. Here's one for you now. I've had a tweet about George Best. I knew this would come up because I get accused then of being a virtue signaller, because I would never deny somebody treatment based on my moral compunction, my moral annoyance with something that they've done to make themselves ill. And thank heavens, you wouldn't either, Alex. But I can understand why back in the day when George, God love him, and seriously God love him, had the liver transplant and then just continued to drink. And I can understand people at the time saying, what a waste of time that was. What a waste of money. And will it make these amazing surgeons that are able to do these amazing operations, will it make people think in the future about who they'll give a liver transplant to? That was, you know, an exceptional case, because we all know who George Best is. And I don't have any answer for that. I could have predicted that George wouldn't have stopped drinking, not because I knew him personally, but, you know, being involved in sports journalism and in radio for years, I knew people who knew George, and that liver transplant was a waste of time. But I still would stand by that. I wouldn't want any surgeon to say beforehand, hey, George, you've got a perfect match. You're next in line, but you can't have it, George, because I don't think you'll stop boozing. Sorry, Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, I would go back to what I said earlier about that when once you've gone past the medical red lines, the rest of it is purely political. And I don't necessarily have a strong view either way on whether heavy drinkers who find it difficult or impossible to give up should have liver transplants. But what I do feel strongly is that these are public decisions. They're not medical decisions. And that doctors, while they have all the expertise in how to transplant a liver and the impact of alcohol on the liver and so on, they don't have any greater moral superiority to the average person in the street when it comes to whether or not the taxpayers' resources should be used to provide health care to people whose addictions result in them having health problems. I mean, if you think about it, it's not just about the extreme cases like alcoholism and lung cancer. It's also, and I'd be interested to know, by the way, whether people feel the same about denying lung cancer treatment to heavy smokers as they do about George Best. But if you think about risk in general, we all know, for example, and I'm partially sighted now, I'm registered blind, so I now make sure that I always cross the road at traffic lights. Whereas when I was a teenager, I routinely crossed the road whenever and wherever I felt like it, and happily stood on white lines in the middle of roads while cars zoomed by me in both directions. Unfortunately, I survived it. But you see the point I'm making?
Yeah, I do.
People who do that are much more likely to get hit by a car. And because they've done something stupid and taken a risk, do we automatically deny them care? These are ultimately democratic moral judgments. And some places, like famously the state of Oregon in the US about 30 years ago, they had a wide public consultation as to what conditions should and shouldn't be prioritized and so on, because they took the view that the public had a right to say. And I believe that as well. If we're in a democracy, then let's find ways, whether it's social surveys or something else, of getting the public to say. Let's not just consult the public when we want to make cuts, which is what the governments always do. Let's talk to the public about their health priorities in an informed way, like I'm doing now, that allows them to make informed judgments.
It's horrendous that you and I are speaking, and we've got a sizable audience. That's true. It's not, you know, it's not bravado. We have a pretty big audience. But guys like you, Alex, with your experience, your career, your history, you should be speaking on these matters in depth on the national media. But the media doesn't want to have these discussions around cuts and what cuts are doing to people. When we mentioned about 15 minutes ago that it is government policy on other issues, other social issues, that are making people sicker, not people's addiction to sugar, which is a problem, obviously. We had a lot of tweets on that. But these are things that we don't have these discussions, Alex. How frustrating is it for somebody like you to be watching the 6 o'clock news on BBC or on Sky, and that these discussions are not had? Or if they are, 4 or 5 minutes is given over to them, and then there's no in-depth, there's no chance for the viewer to get their teeth into a subject. It's all over very quickly, and then move on to the sport. We don't have a media, really, do we?
I agree. I've spent 40 years in public health, more than that, 45, being frustrated by that. So to be honest, I've given up being frustrated and I've become more political. Just so you know, you introduced me as a senior lecturer.
I always do. Yeah.
I'm now an honorary senior lecturer because I'm officially retired, but I still do honorary work, you know, lecturing and so on at Liverpool, also at Chester and Durham. But what I've done is I put my money where my mouth is. I also now chair the Socialist Health Association, which is a Labour Party affiliate. Other health associations are available.
that's a brilliant thing. And how far will that go? I mean, have you considered?
Well, to give you an example, yeah. Richie, I was the person who co-authored and proposed a motion at the 2017 Labour Party conference, which was carried unanimously to fully renationalise the NHS. And as a result of that motion, that is still Labour Party policy. So that's how I try and make change happen, through politics as well as through the more conventional sort of public health channels.
Could that see eventually you standing, Alex? I mean,
I think I'm probably a bit old for that, Richie. I was born before the National Health Service.
No, I know that. I do know that, but I know you're partially sighted, but you're able-bodied. You've got a mind as sharp as a scalpel. You're very bright. You're bright beyond belief. I would imagine that Labour would be very interested in somebody like you.
Well, that's for them to say, I'm afraid, not for me to say.
You believe in Corbyn, Alex, don't you? When we last spoke, because I gave up on politics years ago. I did, as a journalist covering politics forever. For me, the wealthiest people in the world win, no matter which politician gets in. And for me, and we won't get into this today, but it's about the creation of money. Because of our money system and how money is created, I've never believed that it matters which politicians win the day, which party wins the day. But I know that you very much believe in Corbyn. And I criticise him a lot. Not because I'm, you know, a conservative or because I'm on the right of that. I'm not. In fact, I'm much harder on the Tories because they're in government. So because I criticise him, I'm going to shut up, not interrupt, and I'm certainly not going to follow what you have to say with any editorialising of my own. Why do you believe in Corbyn?
Well, I'm a socialist, and I've been a socialist since I was at school, more or less. And because I believe, obviously, in a fair, much more equal society where everyone has equal opportunities. In fact, long before I knew anything about politics, I had beliefs which later made me realise that I was on the far left. Like, I thought that every refuse collector should earn the same as every doctor or prime minister for every hour they worked, because people can't help the size of brain they're born with or the opportunities that privilege gives them or whatever. So, you know, whether someone ends up as say, a manual labourer or a skilled worker or a professional or technical or managerial or whatever, so much of it is due to chance. And therefore, there's no reason why Theresa May should earn more than my refuse collector. So for every hour they work. So that puts me probably on the far left, because I'm sure there's a lot of people in the Labour Party that wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah.
They say, oh, you spent so long at medical school. Well, I enjoyed it. I don't want extra money or privilege because of that. But anyway, so, and also I used to go to parties. Am I allowed to digress slightly?
You are, of course. I'm loving this. Go ahead, Alex.
I was brought up in a trendy part of London, and I used to go to parties a lot. And it seemed terribly unfair to me that if you happened to have been born looking attractive and you were a good dancer and all that, you know, you ended up with more partners than people who didn't have those characteristics. So it seemed obvious to me that the state ought to provide parties to enable people to get together and so on. So I'm a socialist through and through. And Labour, as you know, was more leftish 40 years ago than it was for most of the time in between. Particularly, or certainly more leftish when Michael Foot was the leader at the beginning of the 80s. And then there was a great big space gap before Corbyn took over. And particularly during the Blair period, Labour lurched to the right and became part of the, you know, international capitalism, really. So I've been a socialist forever. It's Labour that's changed rather than me. And I'm just delighted that we've now got, to be honest, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell and Emily Thornberry and all the rest of them, they're more like Scandinavian social democrats than they are socialists. I'm not saying anything against them. Of course, they are socialists, but in terms of the policies they put forward, the very popular manifesto at the last election, it was more social democracy, which was kind of destroyed by the Blair government, than socialism. I mean, people call, you know, Blair and Corbyn and MacDonald Marxists and so on. And it's just absolute nonsense. If you're looking at their policies, they're leftish social democrats. If you believe in fairness and equity, you know, you can't object to the kind of policies they're putting forward. Obviously, they both understand, like you clearly do, Richie, international capitalism and what it is that ultimately how transnational corporations work and the Washington consensus and so on, and what really determines many people's lives, particularly on a global scale. But, you know, they're the nearest to true socialism that Labour has had for many, many, many decades. And I for one, was just absolutely delighted when Labour finally came back to the beliefs that I'd had all the time.
These are going to be very interesting next few months, of course, with what happens with Brexit and whether that will trigger an election this year, even though the fixed term Parliament Act, of course, comes into play. Alex, I want to say, just before we run out of time, it's been great catching up with you. I think it's nearly 2 years since you were on the programme. And judging by the reaction we've had on Twitter, and you can see it yourself later on, the reaction has been absolutely terrific. You're on Twitter. Alex is on Twitter. He's at Buzhna. And that's spelled B-U-Z-H-N-A, at Buzhna on Twitter. Not radical enough, but just before we wind it up today, because it's amazing you saying leftish social democrats. I've got a friend and an important guy to know here in Manchester. He's a genuine socialist like yourself, Michael, my mate Michael Cohen. And Michael works in security at the University of Manchester. He's a very bright man, very well-read man. And like yourself, he's referred to Jeremy et al. As left social democrats. I get from people like you that you'd rather they were a tad more... radical can sound like a dirty... I don't think it's a dirty word, but a tad more radical, maybe.
Yeah. But as I told you, Richie, because I'm more politically active now, and also because of my 45 years in public health, I just got used to the idea that you can't necessarily expect your values and your views to be followed by the establishment, and that you make the most of every opportunity. I chair my constituency now in Liverpool, so I'm used to the idea that the Labour Party is a broad church and that, you know, that we welcome everybody, you know, to the Labour Party, whatever their beliefs are, anyone that can sign up to Labour values. And in that way, whatever my personal values are, and whatever I might like to see happen, I'm quite used to the idea that you make the most of every opportunity, you see the socialist light at the end of the tunnel, and you just keep the train moving in that direction.
Alex, thanks for coming back today. It was a tonic to have you back on the programme. It's the Socialist Health Association, and the website is sochealth.co.uk, so sochealth.co.uk. That's www.sochealth.co.uk. Alex chairs that organisation. I'm on the website now, and an honorary lecturer in public health at Liverpool University. Thanks, mate, for coming back. It's always brilliant to have you on.
Thanks, Richie. It's been a pleasure.
And listen, don't wait to be asked again. Come back anytime, Alex.
Okay, will do.
Cheers, mate. Bye for now. The brilliant Dr. Alex Scott-Samuel, live from Liverpool this afternoon, is coming up for 90 seconds to the top of the hour. A lot of comments on that. Patrick tweets, Richie, I would probably vote for Jeremy to become a real MP, as I think he is a decent fellow with some knowledge, intellect, but not whilst he is part of a political party. Patrick is talking about Jeremy Corbyn. I would vote for him if he was an independent, I think is what Alex is saying. But not while he's part, Patrick is saying, not while he is part of a political party, all of which should be outlawed, says Patrick. We need a hashtag pure democracy that elects worthy individuals. And I can't be a hypocrite, and I can't agree with that, Patrick, but I respect it. I'm not going to repeat what it is, I believe, because I've said it too many times there. Hi to Susan, Aunt Ruby Dragon. How you doing, Susan? Hi to Andy Newman. To David, who tweets as cartoon drunk. Nice to hear from you, David. Thanks for that support, mate. Hi to Mark Richards as well, who said that Alex Scott Samuel would make a very good guest speaker at something called Truth Juice. No doubt he would. Hi to Mawinga. Hi to Nadia as well. There was a story I tweeted just before I came on air to something to do, I can't find it now, to something to do with gender neutral birth certificates in a certain state in the United States. Yeah. David Stanford, not thrilled with Alex. How you doing, David? What a pompous view. Sorry. Bigger brains, asks David. I don't know exactly what Alex said to trigger that, but thanks for that, mate. I appreciate that. Rich tweets, if everybody earned the same amount of money, money would have no value. That was in reference to a comment that Alex made about how the refuse collector should earn as much, in his opinion, as the Prime Minister of the country. There shouldn't be any disparity between the salaries, Alex said there as well. Yeah, good stuff. Loads of tweets on that. You know how to follow what people are tweeting me. Just go to twitter.com and put Richie Allen Show without any spaces. So it's all one word, Richie Allen Show. If you then press enter, you will see what other people are tweeting to me. Now, as I was going about my rounds earlier today, I came across a podcast. The Guardian makes its own podcasts. Why not? Brave New World. The Guardian is struggling to make money. It's it's still in print, The Guardian. It continues to print, I think, but there are concerns it might go the way of The Independent and it might go out of print. That's not a good thing. No matter what you think of The Guardian, and I don't have a lot of time for the stories, but the editorials that I read in The Guardian. I don't have a lot of time for them personally, but I shudder at the prospect of newspapers going out of print like The Independent did. Anyway, The Guardian makes a podcast. One of the podcast topics this week, and this was published this morning, you can find it on The Guardian website. It was a podcast about Andy Wakefield and the MMR vaccine scandal when Andy, who's been on this programme several times, as you know, said that research that he was part of found a link between the three jabs together, the measles, mumps and rubella jab, that those three jabs, that there was a link between those and autism in some youngsters. And at the time, he recommended, did Andy, if I remember this correctly, I think I do, that those jabs be given separately and with I think a gap of 12 months, a 12-month gap between each one, right? His research at the time was endorsed. It was accepted. It was peer-reviewed. It was in The Lancet. And then something happened and it all changed and it was discredited. Now, I've talked a lot about this in the past. If you haven't seen Del Bigtree's film Vaxxed, which obviously was made with Andy Wakefield, it's a film you must see, I believe. You know, whether you've got a child or not, wherever you are in the world, you've got to see the film anyway. The Guardian podcast was entitled, Is the Anti-Vaccine Movement Putting Lives at Risk? And it was one of several articles or podcasts that featured in the national press since the dawn of the new year, all questioning the mindset or mindsets of people who are asking questions about vaccine safety. More and more and more and more people asking questions about vaccines are being accused of putting other people in harm's way. Right? This is very serious stuff. So when we come back, I'll be speaking with a lady who won a settlement for her own son, right? Back in two. Right, music from Aretha Franklin on The Richie Allen Show. It's just gone 5 minutes past the hour. It's 6:05. We always say past the hour, just in case you're listening overseas, as many people do these days. So let's talk then about this very disappointing podcast put out by The Guardian today. I will tweet a link to it, but you can find it if you go to theguardian.com. It's entitled, Is the Anti-Vaccine Movement Putting Lives at Risk? And it features, the podcast features Sarah Bosley, who's been a health correspondent for The Guardian for many, many years. And in the 15-minute segment, she talks about Dr. Andy Wakefield, as I mentioned before, Aretha Franklin there, about his research and his study into the safety of the MMR vaccine, what they found, what it led to, and the problems then that Andy experienced. All of this documented in the brilliant Vaxxed, which was made by Del Bigtree and Andy Wakefield. I can't recommend that highly enough. It's really important. And my next guest was featured in that particular film as well. And I'm really looking forward to speaking with her. She founded JABS, that's JABS, Justice Awareness and Basic Support, which is a support group for vaccine damaged children. She fought for nearly two decades to win compensation for her son Robert, who's in his early 20s now, I think. Robert suffered severe brain damage after being given the MMR vaccine. He was given ImraVax, which had actually been banned in the UK 2 months before. 2 months before he was given it. And a tribunal concluded that it could be no coincidence that Robert suffered his first seizure 10 days after being vaccinated. And his family, his mum, was awarded £90,000 in compensation after years, as I said, of campaigning and working and pursuing justice for him. Let's welcome to the programme, live from Wigan, Jackie Fletcher. Jackie, it's a real pleasure to have you on. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm very well, thank you. And I'm so pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you.
Now, it's lovely of you to come on, because ordinarily I give people a bit of notice and we give them a few days or a week. And when I saw the article this morning, I remembered you from Vaxxed. I'd read about you. It did dawn on me that we'd never spoken before, which is a disgrace, really. You've been over road, as it were, across the road, more or less. So it's great to have you on. Do you want to tell us, because I haven't spoken to too many mums or dads who actually won compensation over a vaccine injury. Do you want to talk to us about Robert, Jackie, in your own time?
Yeah, I'll be happy to do. Robert had the MMR vaccine when he was 13 months old back in 92. And up to that point, he was spot on with his development. He was beginning to talk. He was happy and healthy. And 10 days after it, he had a massive seizure and we were rushed into hospital. In the hospital, that was the first of many, many emergencies. But because we'd been warned that he might have a mild reaction 10 days after the vaccine, it was the first thing I raised with the consultants in the A&E department. But they instantly dismissed it. That one shrugged his shoulder and said, no, it won't be anything to do with that. It's a coincidence. And that was the first of many, many times when the word coincidence was levelled at us. Robert, over subsequent months, developed very severe, erratic, uncontrolled epilepsy. He developed a left-sided weakness, which has robbed him of his ability to stand unaided, so he's wheelchair-bound now. He developed a problem that we were told was an acquired immune deficiency, which meant something had happened to him to upset his immune system, and he was constantly going down with infections. But the worst of it was that it robbed him of his speech and understanding, and he lost things over the months. Each time we were seeing specialists, I again would raise it with them that everything was fine up till the vaccine. And even when we were asking what causes epilepsy, they would skirt around everything. What they didn't tell us was that viruses could cause epilepsy, and just from doing local research in the library, the main viruses that could cause epilepsy were measles, mumps and rubella. And it was only subsequent to that that we got hold of the drug product sheet. Now, these are sheets that parents don't normally see. They arrive in the vaccine boxes, and in there it states what's in the vaccine, when it shouldn't be given, and the side effects that are known to the manufacturer. And everything that Robert was now living with was mentioned there as a rare event. But it was only as we got those sheets that the doctor said, well, yes, very rarely could be the vaccine, but you'll never prove it. Just get on with your life. So it was that hardness that we couldn't get come to terms with. We expected doctors to be concerned and wanting to investigate, not only for Robert's sake, but the vaccine was still being used.
There was no compassion, Jackie. On the one hand, you're dealing with witnessing what's happening to Robert, which I can't imagine, but it must have been horrendous for you and his dad. And you have to deal with that, but you also have to get to the bottom of what caused it. And these guys were fairly hard, fairly compassionless, and until you started digging stuff out, they weren't helpful at all.
No, they weren't. And we were actually meeting other parents in the waiting room to see the same consultants. And we were being told, or they had been told, as we had, that this was such an unusual event that the doctor would take a special interest in it. He'd never come across this before. And the other parents were using the exact same words. So what seemed to appear to us was that the consultants who were seeing the hardcore cases, not the GPs, these at consultant level, were acting as sponges and taking in what parents were saying, but not doing anything about it. And that, as I say, was so hard because we felt it not only might have affected Robert's treatment for his condition if they knew the correct source, but also to safeguard other people's children, so they didn't go down the same route.
There's so many questions and there's so many things we're going to speak about between now and the top of the hour. Was there ever any reason given as to why Imravax was harmful? What was wrong with Imravax that led to Robert's condition? Did anybody ever explain that to you?
No, what we found, again, through our own efforts, was that the chief medical officer had issued a press release stating that Imravax and a like vaccine called Pluzarix, which was also MMR, had a mumps component that was linked with mumps meningitis. It was causing inflammation of the brain in some children. And so the chief medical officer made light of it by saying that we're just withdrawing it, we're not banning it, but we're going to continue using the other vaccine, which is made by Merck. Again, through our efforts, we found that even the Merck product, it was minuted in the Department of Health minutes that both the Pluzarix Imravax and the Merck product were all linked with neurological problems, but they'd still sanctioned it to be introduced into the UK population. And within a week of its introduction, one of the first families that contacted our group when we formed in 94 reported that their little girl had been given MMR when she was 18 months old, had had a seizure a week later, similar to Rob, but she subsequently died of a seizure and been awarded a vaccine damage payment. So even though that dated back to the first week of its introduction, the government's Department of Health had done nothing to stop that vaccine going any further.
They left other children have the vaccine, knowing that it had impacted so negatively on Robert and on other children, and they allowed it.
Because this little girl had been vaccinated in the first week of the opening campaign in 88. My boy got it in 92. So all those children in between could have been saved, and then all the children even after Robert, because it's still going on now. We still have families contacting us reporting problems, and it's not just in Britain. There are similar groups to JABS in America, in New Zealand, in Australia, wherever vaccines are used, there are vaccine damage support groups.
Let me just give a link now to Jabs. It's jabs.org.uk.
That's right. Thank you.
Not at all. No, we'll put links out there on Twitter, and I know our listeners will retweet it because there will be people listening to this who are concerned by it. And you're segueing now into something very important, because when we spoke earlier today, you shocked me now, to be honest, Jackie. And I don't shock that easily, but you talked to me about yellow cards and uh-huh. and doctors, and I want to talk about this. This is, some of our listeners might be aware of this. It's jabs.org.uk. We're speaking to Jackie Fletcher. Jackie founded Jabs, and she secured compensation for her son, Robert, who she had to fight for nearly two decades for, by the way, who was very, very severely injured after being given ImraVax, this MMR vaccine. Courageous family, courageous woman. Jackie Fletcher is on the line with us today. Jackie, you shocked me today. You said that you believe that doctors, and you said that there's a system by which doctors in the UK today must flag up any sign or any concerns about a vaccine injury. And you mentioned yellow cards. I'm going to shut the hell up, and you're going to tell me about that system and how it's not being used. Go ahead.
Right. Yes, at the moment, if anybody has a problem with a drug product, the doctor is supposed to report all suspected adverse reactions using what's called a yellow card system. So they complete a card documenting the person's details and the suspected reaction, and are supposed to then send it off to the government watchdog, which is the Medicines Health Regulatory Authority, known as MHRA. Now, those cards, we know they are vastly underreported. The government itself, the Department of Health itself, accepts that only about 10%, and that's on the optimistic side, get put forward in the correct manner by a yellow card being completed. And I actually took part in a meeting with the MHRA in February last year with a couple of support groups to do with the cervical cancer damaged children. And at that meeting, I raised with the chief executive that when the yellow cards, even though we know there are few and far between, get put forward, what do they actually do with the forms when they land on their desk? And I was told that if it's a reaction they've come across before, for example, a fever fit, as happened with my son, they know fever fits can be caused by vaccines, so they just tick it off, log it, and do no more. And I said that there should be follow-up, and was surprised to learn that there is no follow-up 6 to 12 months after the event to find out if the individual has fully recovered from the adverse reaction or has further deteriorated. So they're operating a system without any accurate safety data. When I put it to one of the scientists around the table, why do you not follow this up? And he said, it's hard enough to get the doctors to fill the form in the first place, Jesus, let alone follow it up, which I thought was a diabolical thing for someone to say. And I then said, well, can the MHRA instigate by contacting the doctor from the MHRA and get the information that way? And they said, well, it's something we could perhaps look into. And I made it clear that based on their information, if my son's reaction had been put forward initially as a fever fit, which turned out to be a misdiagnosis, according to the records, my boy is fit and healthy. They don't know how he's still like a 14-month-old when he's 27 years of age. And if the system's failing for him, how many other children is it failing for?
This shocked me this morning now. Because what Jackie Fletcher is live on the line to us from Wigan, and Jackie founded Jabs. That's jabs.org.uk. It's a support group for the families of vaccine-injured children. And I know you've heard what Jackie said, because she's brilliantly eloquent and well able to talk for herself, but I'm just going to repeat it because it bears repeating. Doctors are supposed to log any incidences, not just to do with vaccines, But for any adverse reactions to any medication, they're supposed to log those, and then it moves down the chain, it moves to a laboratory or to a scientist. What Jackie's telling us is, not only is this not happening nearly enough, it's only happening a fraction of the amount of times that it should happen, but in most cases, or many cases, the doctor or the scientist who gets the yellow card from the doctor and sees that, oh, a child A had a bit of a fit and a bit of a fever after a vaccine. Ah, well, we've seen that one before. Not too much to worry about. We'll put that in a filing cabinet. So what we don't learn then is how many other children, number one, have this type of fit or fever reaction to a vaccine. But as Jackie pointed out brilliantly there, more importantly, too, where's the follow-up 12 months down the line to see how that child is doing now? Jackie, that's a bombshell, that. Isn't it?
It is terrible that this system is still as it is. It was raised back in 1974 during the whooping cough damaged children, when Jack Ashley, sadly he's died now, but he raised it in the House of Commons and challenged the government back in 1974 to say that they were operating the system in exactly the same cavalier manner that they're doing now.
Why is that? I mean, you would have said to some of these people, why? Why is it happening? I know you got an answer from one of the scientists who said that, you know, they're lucky if they get any reporting from the doctors at all. But you would have thought, Jackie, that somebody would have blown the whistle, that some medical man or woman, some laboratory technician, man or woman, would blow the whistle on this and say, because the public needs to hear this, Jackie.
There should be. I mean, during that meeting, we raised about the girls that had been damaged by HPV vaccine, the cervical cancer jab that's offered to teenage girls upwards. And we reported on the severity. These are life-changing events in teenage girls who've been, up to that point, fit and healthy and developmentally sound. And in Britain, we've got about 500 girls that fell into that category. And we said to the MHRA, you've got a prime opportunity here before even thinking about unfolding the system for boys, which is what they want to do. They should do a scientific investigation of the 500 girls already believed to have been damaged by HPV vaccine here in Britain. The parents wanted their children to be clinically examined to get to the root of the devastating injuries, but they didn't want to go down that route at all. And it's like banging your head against a brick wall. There's so many times over the years that we've met with Department of Health ministers, DWP ministers, health ministers, chief medical officers, and said, there are flaws in the system which are putting children needlessly at risk that could be improved immediately, and they're failing to do that.
You didn't give up, Jackie, for 20 years fighting for justice for Robert, and whether it is justice or not, that's for you to say. It's not for me or anybody else to say, because I imagine, and I certainly don't want to make you upset, I don't want to make you sad, but I imagine that caring for Robert is fairly difficult. I imagine fairly difficult is a big understatement.
It's a 24-hour job. I sleep beside him. We have twin beds because he fits through the night. And my husband and I have to anticipate all his needs. He can't even feed himself, and he wears incontinence pads at 27. And we understand his ways, but he cannot. He's got very limited communication. And we were actually pursuing a legal case for many years, because what we wanted to do was to get a proper budget for him so that we could bring in carers to look after him when my husband and I are not able to do it ourselves. We did not want Robert to end up in some kind of institution. We wanted him to stay around us as long as possible. At the time, which was in the early, 2003, there were 1,400 children similar to Robert. We've got a massive court action going ahead. And in America, there were 5,000 children. And the political system is such that they could not afford for our children to actually be compensated, because that would have opened the floodgates for more cases. In the UK, our cases ended just 6 months just before we were due to go to court properly. And in America, what's come to light is that experts have given opinions on the first case, changed the mind, but then being taken away from the case because they've changed their mind, but their original opinion has been put to cover further cases. It's the deeper it gets, it's like an onion. You take off one skin and there's another one underneath. And what we find is the pharmaceutical industry has infiltrated the political system so much that it's hard to put a piece of paper between the two. There's so many conflicts of interest. Like in Britain, we've got the Joint Committee for Vaccination and Immunisation is described as an independent body charged with deciding which vaccines to introduce into the UK system. And yet you only need to look on its own website and you find that its members has got direct and indirect links with the vaccine industry.
It's not hidden in any way. It's kind of in plain sight, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yep. And you want, the public wants and public expects that public health bodies who are paid for by taxpayers will act in the public's interest. But what we find is public health officers, even now, will do media interviews and say, MMR is perfectly safe, perfectly effective, which belittles the families who've received a vaccine damage award, because some of the families have had them after the child has died, and it also disowns the drug company's own vaccine product information, because all the adverse reactions are listed on the...
On the packaging, yeah, on the insert.
On the packaging insert,
yeah.
Yes.
As we've seen in Ireland, I got into the Gardasil scandal a couple of years ago. We spoke this morning about Anna Cannon and regret.ie and the problems they've had. And I want to talk a little bit about that in a minute, the media coverage of this and the backlash by the media. You see, the Guardian podcast today is a dreadful piece of so-called journalism. And I don't want to be personally attacking any man or woman working in the media, but Sarah Bosley should be ashamed of it. It's rubbish, because she's airbrushed over and omitted so many genuine facts about the studies done by Andrew Wakefield and his colleagues. And what you were telling us today, and you know, after speaking with you this morning, obviously I had a little bit of a look into the system of reporting in the UK. I didn't know anything about it till I spoke to you. And everything you've said to me is right. I can't fault what you've said to me. So we must believe, it's not because we want to believe, we must believe, and by we I don't mean you, because I know you hear from these people through your website, but the MMR vaccine must be still injuring children in this country today, but because of the failure of the yellow card system, which you described, we're none the wiser. And then you have podcasts like The Guardian, and they're basically saying to people, ah, look, the MMR controversy, it's all been proven to be nonsense now because, well, we never hear about any children who've been injured now. But you've explained to me, and I've looked into it and I've found that you're absolutely right, you've explained why it's not being reported.
That's right, because any science that supports a causal relationship between vaccines and neurological damage in children is being suppressed and the authors attacked. It happens over and over again. The system just has not been thought through properly. And the weak spot is the parents themselves. The parents are now being criticised on social media for daring to discuss their child's adverse reactions. And yet the only motive behind that is they don't want another parent to go down the same route. We're interested in saving children, not harming them. And that's why parents need to have all the information about the diseases in whichever country they live in, because diseases vary depending on whether you're living in Africa or America. And they need to know about they need to have the product insert sheets absolutely every time. You wouldn't believe it when parents ring us and we say, please ask for that from the doctor. Sometimes the parents rung back and said, the nurse has said I don't need that, I'm not clever enough to understand it. So there's so many awful things actually being said, you just would not believe how parents are being treated.
You took a lot of stick, Jackie, over the years, because when fighting Robert's case, you took a lot of abuse, even pre-social media days. And I think there's a lot to be said. You said there that it's to warn other parents off. I think that's absolutely true. But one of the things that concerns me, and I spoke to you today and I did say, look, I don't have any... we don't have children yet, please God, we will someday. But I don't know anybody personally, except the people I've met through the show, but I don't have any personal axe to grind with vaccines. But I know when something is badly wrong and something is up. And I look at the recent stories put out by the media suggesting that anti-vaxxers, which is, they're trying to make that a dirty word. And of course, most people are not anti-vaxxers or anti-anything. They just want to ask questions. They want the questions answered. But to suggest that you're putting lives at risk, I find that very sinister, because I see that leading to the introduction of legislation that would make vaccines mandatory, or certain vaccines mandatory anyway. Now, I know you've written about this, and I'm going to tweet a link out to your excellent article in the BMJ a couple of years ago. No, it's a brilliant article. That's a huge concern. Is that where this is going, mandatory vaccinations?
It seems to be. How I feel is that we're reaching like a tipping point. The Department of Health have been failing in the exercise to try and get more and more people to take up these huge combinations of vaccines, and the only way they can go now is to insist that it's done, to try and make it mandatory. But I'm afraid that won't work. It's actually, they've tried that in the past. They tried it once before in the 1800s, and it did not go down well. There was such hostility and riots and considerable resistance that the plans had to be abandoned. And what we've got to remember here is there's no mandate in the UK for any government to impose compulsory vaccination. We've got to remember that without democratic consent, such a policy would face escalating opposition. So we've got to look at political mandates very carefully. Any suggestion of mandatory, and that should be opposed immediately. No one should be allowed to inject another person. I couldn't come up to you and stick a needle in you, and nobody should have the right to be able to come up to a child of mine. And when they use the term anti-vaxxer, what they're failing to, well, they're intending it as a slur, obviously, but they're actually misusing the word. Our experience with the families who've contacted us is that the family is not anti-vaxxer, they're an ex-vaxxer. They've had 1, 2, 3 children potentially harmed by a vaccine, and they're not going to give it to another one. Certainly I would not let anyone put another vaccine in Robert for very good reasons. But they're losing sight of what's behind the parents saying, no, this is not for me or my child. When actually, for a parent to say that, they have to have very good reasons themselves. They usually have done a tremendous amount of research into it before they step off that conveyor belt.
But people have lost, Jackie. Sorry to interrupt. People have lost the ability to think for themselves. We used to have the ability to think for ourselves. There was a time when somebody would look at you, lovely lady, smart, you won the case for Robert, you saw what happened to him, and there was a time when people would say, well, you know, it's a very good reason why this lady is asking questions. People don't think like that anymore. You know, it's easy now to demonise people, and I've been stunned. I said this to you today. Some of the girls, I shouldn't call them girls, women, ladies in Ireland, whose daughters were affected by Gardasil, they've been called child abusers. Do you know, one of the guys who called him a child abuser is a guy who lectures at Oxford University. And he said, by asking questions, you're a child abuser. I can't imagine anything worse to be said to a parent than you're a child abuser. But people have lost the ability to think critically. The wider public, Jackie, should be saying, well, hang on a second. These are nice women. What is there for them to gain by asking these questions? What? Nothing. So obviously there's something wrong. That's what the wider public should be thinking. But
yes,
I don't know whether they are thinking that or not.
Well, I'm hoping so. Certainly we get a tremendous amount of phone calls every week where parents are contacting us and saying, I'm being told my child needs to have all these next week and I'm not happy about it. What am I right? And we try and help talk the parents through so they know what options they've got. And we know, we encourage them to access information about the illnesses so it doesn't become a bogeyman. You know, we're talking about in the main in Britain, and many of these diseases are no longer a major issue. If you're travelling to different parts of the world, the risk-benefit might change. But what we're looking at is on a need-to-have basis all the way down the line. But what parents need to know more than anything is about what's in vaccines, because they're entering the body in a way different to how a child would normally catch something. Say, with measles, for example, for a child to catch measles, they have to come within coughing or sneezing range of someone that's been incubating measles. That virus, the droplets, would enter the back of the child's throat and would enter the body in a way that the body's designed to defend itself. So before the virus has got a real hold, the body is in defence mode. But when you give a vaccine, it's bypassing that entry point. It's going in an arm or a leg. It doesn't just contain measles. It might contain mumps and rubella. It may also have two other needles in two other limbs at the same time. But there's also the adjuvants, the elements within vaccines that are supposed to make the vaccines work better. But these adjuvants have got their own reactive properties. Like there's aluminium in a vaccine, which is a neurotoxin, and it's designed to attach itself to the virus to help it have a better reactive property within the body. There's also other things in vaccines that are designed to help break barriers. Well, one of the most important barriers a person has is the blood-brain barrier. But these scientists have come up with a nice little adjuvant that will take the aluminium and the virus into the brain, into cross barriers. And where vaccines are designed to trick the immune system, why should it come as any surprise when it tricks the body in a way that you don't want?
You've done something. You've done something amazing there. And no guest has done this, including Dr. Wakefield, who's been on this show in the past and will be again in the future. You've done something that nobody else has done. You've drawn attention to how we ingest germs or bacteria that might give us a cough or a cold or the flu, as opposed to how the vaccine is introduced to the body. That's massively important. And, you know, I don't reflect on that often enough. It's really important you're saying this. I also want to point out, by the way, Jackie Fletcher is our guest, and it's jabs.org.uk. I've been trying to get doctors who are in favour of vaccination to come on this programme for years. And sometimes they will flirt with the programme on Twitter, like a recent paediatrician based in British Columbia, who flirted with the idea of coming on. And I said to him, he very, very much pro-vaccine. He was being very rude to people on Twitter who are asking questions about vaccines. And I asked him to come on the programme, pointed out that it's a professional show made by a real journalist, and that I would be very nice and very kind, but I would put some questions to him. Eventually he wouldn't come on, and this is a huge problem. They won't come on. They prefer these days, sadly. It's almost an affront to academia. They prefer to be rude to people rather than say, well, I'll tell you what, Richie, you sound like a sound enough guy. I'll come on and I will explain to you, the layman, why vaccines are very important and why they are safe. They won't come on, because there will be listeners going, Richie, you've got Jackie on now. Where's the other side of it? They won't come on. It's sickening, but they won't come on. Anyway, Jackie, I digress, because your explanation of how the vaccine enters the body and how we ordinarily get bacteria through sneezes or coughs is brilliant, and it's hugely important. It really is.
Thank you.
No, it's vital stuff, this. Loads of tweets on it. It's 19 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. We've got Jackie for another 10 minutes or thereabouts. Jackie, what about political interest in this? But before we talk about political interest, a very good friend of mine has sent me a question for you. And she asks, and you probably get this all the time, and you don't have to answer this, or you do, it's up to you. Is it just about money, Jackie, with these pharmaceutical companies? Or is it something a bit more sinister? Some people say it's an agenda to keep us sick. Others say it's about something even more sinister than that. Do you wonder yourself about what's really going on with this vax agenda?
I do wonder, because initially they started off with the really serious illnesses like diphtheria back in the 50s, polio, tetanus. And then as the system has moved on, particularly when in America, the pharmaceutical companies were given an indemnity, they were getting fed up of potential lawsuits and were threatening the US government that they would no longer provide vaccines. So the government decided that rather than have people going down with measles, they would give the drug companies an indemnity so that if anyone wanted to sue them, they would have to go through the United States government's courts first. So that then let the drug companies off the hook. They'd got an indemnity and could not be touched. So they'd got a license then to create more vaccines. And they're very lucrative, because the more vaccines they make and the more combinations they make, they've then got the ready market, especially when the US government has mandatory vaccines in various states around the country. So it, in a way, it was a license to print money. And they've produced more and more in bigger and greater combinations, and losing sight of the fact of whether a child actually needs something or not. And again, to give you an example, our babies in the UK now, at 8 weeks of age, will be given a six-in-one that includes hepatitis B. Now, hepatitis B is a very serious liver condition that's contracted through sexual activity, sharing needles, or working in a profession that comes in contact with other people's blood, like a prison officer.
There's no need for it, Jackie. There's no need for hepatitis.
Not. Yeah. There's not. And to me, it seems to be a license for the drug companies to have a nice new patent that they can then use to the maximum. Whether there's any other agenda going on, that would be speculation. I don't know.
Yeah,
but that's
enough.
The way my mind has worked with it, that they've just got this very lucrative system and a ready-made market.
You've horrified some of our listeners talking, just to go back to the yellow card system, that currently doctors are supposed to report when they hear back from patients that there's been an adverse reaction to a treatment. That includes vaccines. Jackie was speaking to me about this morning, and she went into it in great detail today. It shocked a lot of people who didn't know about it. But doctors, Jackie was able to demonstrate, and go to jabs.org.uk, doctors are not reporting. Now, some of them are, but mostly they're not reporting when mum goes back to the surgery and says, Alicia or Alex is vomiting or has a fever or had a fit. It's not being reported and pushed up the chain for it to be reviewed. That has shocked a lot of people, Jackie.
It's a terrible thing, because that is where they're supposed to get their safety data from, and that's supposed to be, when you roll it out across the population, the means to find out if there's any problems occurring. But they're not doing their job properly. The system is failing, and it's the parents who are on the downside of it when it goes wrong.
So the truth is, they say, well, vaccines are safe. We see that because it only happens to one in a million kids. But that is probably grossly untrue, because if doctors are not reporting on it, the truth is we don't know the numbers of children whom are injured by vaccines.
Exactly, because like, we've got a vaccine damage payment unit, but it took us 20 years and much persistence to get them to actually look at Robert's original records from when he was 13 months old, which demonstrated that it was not a fever fit. His temperature was normal throughout the 2 days that we were in hospital, where the doctor had been describing it as a febrile fever fit. He did not have a fever. Now, it took us 20 years for them to determine that it was a proper epileptic fit, which then caused brain damage and subsequent problems. And if they're not getting that right and not reporting it, it's so very, very difficult. And when you look at the Vaccine Damage Payment Unit, the criteria is so strict that most parents fall foul of the system. For example, if your child dies from a childhood vaccine, say they're given the 8-in-1 at 8 weeks of age and they die, you cannot make a claim to the Vaccine Damage Payment Unit because your child hasn't reached the second birthday.
Jesus.
You can only apply after your child turns 2. And if you think about it, when are most baby jabs given? Under 2. And we've questioned that. We've said, why on earth have they got such a ludicrous clause in there? But they've said it can't be changed. You've got to prove that you're over 60% damaged. And to give you a horrendous example of that, there was one young boy who'd been damaged by the polio vaccine. The Vaccine Damage Unit accepted that the polio virus had caused paralysis in his left leg. It was shorter, withered, and he needed a caliper. But his other leg was fine. So he was only 50% damaged.
That's disgraceful.
And therefore didn't qualify for a payment. But the fact that he had to change the course of his life and he could no longer follow his father into the RAF wasn't taken into account.
I just want to point out as well, Jackie, that's a disgusting thing to say, that the damage is minimal because it's only one leg. Is how you could say that to a mum or a dad with you know, without any shame. Speaking to you this morning, obviously did a bit of research, and I found stories in the Belfast Telegraph and stories on the BBC Wales website, stories from 2017 and 2018, stories that show across Wales and across Northern Ireland, there's up to a 70% increase in children showing you know, signs of possibly being on the autism spectrum. 70%. And at what point does politicians or health chiefs say, well, hang on a second, we've got a serious problem here. How can this be possible? How can how can children showing autism symptoms, for want of a better word, how can it be exponentially growing by 69% over the past 5 years? That's in Northern Ireland. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. 69% in the last 5 years. How can nobody say, hang on a second, stop. What's going on, Jackie? Surely somebody must say what's happening.
It is absolutely appalling. When we first set up and autism started to be reported to us after vaccines, I looked up the national rates and it was something like 1 in 10,000 could potentially go down with autism. Now it's like 1 in 67 and it's growing all the time. In America, they've actually been paying out to children that have been vaccine damaged and have ended up on the autistic spectrum. Well, what they tend to do in America is in the special courts, they can ask parents to sign a non-disclosure statement. So they'll get the money, but they're not supposed to speak about it.
Lovely.
Now, one or two have broken ranks. There was a famous doctor, the father of a little girl called Hannah Poling. He was actually a neurologist and his wife a solicitor. So they did not want to sign a gagging order and they did speak out. And it came to light probably about 10 years ago, might even be a bit longer than that now, that their child had been given 8 vaccines in one day, including MMR, and had had a massive reaction and ended up on the autistic spectrum. Because that family spoke out, other families were brave enough in America to speak out too. And further than that, more and more have come through. And I may have mentioned before that at the same time as the UK court cases were going ahead, where there were 1,400 children in Britain who qualified for legal aid, which was no mean task, there were 5,000 children in America. Many of them had been on the autistic spectrum. Now, because it's come to light recently that an expert who'd spoken out for the first case and then changed his mind in America and accepted that autism could result sometimes if a child had a particular condition that involved the powerhouse mitochondrial function within the body. And it came to light that he'd been hushed away, but his original report had been put forward for the subsequent cases, which were then lost. There's now a case where Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is taking a potential suit with the Department of Justice in America to see if these 5,000 cases can be revisited. So the story is not over. It's long and hard and a heavy route to go down, but the families are still out there at the moment, still supporting their own children. But at some point, when the parents start to die off, the full extent of this epidemic will come to light.
I want to mention the website again. It's jabs.org.uk. And I can hear the concern that you have, Jackie, and Mr. Fletcher, whom I spoke with earlier on today, as well, your husband. And you must worry about Robert, you know. I mean, please God, you're long for the world yourselves. You're not going anywhere, hopefully, not for a long time. But of course, you've got concerns about that. And the settlement was, not the settlement, but the award you won was a pittance and was a disgrace,
yeah.
You know, in terms of the care that Robert will need for the rest of his life. And I can hear that in your voice. And you've touched an awful lot of people today, as I can see through the Twitter comments, because we've had literally hundreds of comments come in since we've been on air today. And I want to mention again, if you've been affected by this and you want to learn more about it, find out more about Jackie by going to jabs.org.uk. There are contact details there for Jackie, because we're just about to run out of time. It's absolutely untenable that they will make it mandatory for people to vaccinate their children in this country, even though we've seen it in parts of America, as you said, and in other parts of the world. It's a disgrace. There are a lot of questions that these people have to answer. And it's because of people like you, Jackie, 2 decades, you and your family fighting for justice for Robert and setting up JABS and talking about these issues. You're not going anywhere. You're not going away. I don't believe, no matter how much abuse you might get from people on social media and all the rest of it, you're in the fight. I think you're an amazing woman, Jack. I'm going to give you the final word. We've got about 60 seconds left. Final word to you, and then we'll part company. But I mean this sincerely. Next time you're over in Manchester, let us know via email and let me buy you a cup of coffee to be an absolute honour to meet you. An honour. Final word to you, Jackie.
I would just say to parents, please research the subject. Find out about the illness in the country where you live. Find out about the diseases. And if our government ever has the audacity to suggest compulsory vaccines, whether you're for vaccines, on the fence or anti, it's one area we must all come together and say no mandatory, no compulsion. It's got to be free choice.
Jackie, thanks for giving us your time today. Regards to your husband, the best of luck to you with
you
know, with Robert and the challenges there. Love to Robert as well from everybody listening.
Thank you very much.
Today. And let us know when you're over in Manchester. Let me buy you a cup of coffee. It'd be a pleasure to meet you.
I will do.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Okay,
thanks
good
for your time.
With you.
It was an honour. Believe me, it was an honour. Thanks, Jackie. The lovely Jackie Fletcher there, live on the line from her home in Wigan. The website is jabs.org.uk. jabs.org.uk. I've learned an awful lot there, particularly about reporting adverse reactions and how it's not happening and why it's not happening. I didn't know anything about that prior to today. Hugely important that people understand that as well, when they want to figure out why. Because some people will listen, they will think, well, I vaccinated my child was okay. But lots of children are not okay after vaccination, but it isn't being reported, it isn't being documented. That's more or less it for the programme today. Massive thanks to Jackie Fletcher and Alex Scott Samuel, honorary professor in public health at Liverpool University, these days chairing the Socialist Health Association, speaking to us earlier on about plans for the NHS, but we covered quite a lot in that conversation as well. Thanks to you for your lovely comments. I'll pass them on to Jackie Fletcher a little bit later on. That's more or less it then for the programme today. Got plenty of people lined up this week. We will drop into Hawaii tomorrow to catch up with Michael Rivero. But I'm also hoping to be talking about 5G with a very fascinating lady who's based in Canada. I'm hoping to nail that down today. If not today, if not tomorrow, I should say, it'll be Wednesday. Follow the programme on Twitter. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I will put a couple of extra news roundup videos on YouTube this week as well. Go to youtube.com/Richie Allen Show. That's youtube.com/Richie Allen Show. I did one today and I talked about, if you haven't seen it, it's on YouTube. I talked a little bit about some of the things which I think will happen in 2019 in terms of the independent media, but also in terms of one or two other bits and pieces. I did it this morning. It's on YouTube now. Go to youtube.com. As I said, /Richie Allen Show there. All right. That's it for Monday's programme. Great to be back with you, by the way. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. The programme will be on Podomatic very soon. It'll be on YouTube later on. It'll be on iTunes. It'll be on Spotify. Plenty of places to listen to The Richie Allen Show. Going to leave you with some Joy Division. From Manchester, the Republic of Mancunia. You have a brilliant Monday evening, by the way. Thanks to my guests. Thanks for listening. Speak tomorrow at 5. Bye now.